Good morning, Portland, Maine. You're listening to Tides Morning Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLLB, 1310 AM, and of course, WLLBRadio.com. It is February 28th, last day of the shortest month, right?
Last one, yep.
It feels, maybe it's just kind of, maybe it's just a perceptual thing, but once you get out of February and you're in March, it feels like it's kind of the ninth inning of the winter, right? It feels like March
Definitely.
And April should be, it's going to be muddy, it's going to be wet, but it's not really winter. You wouldn't think of March as was winter.
Yeah. It's not the deep freeze.
Yeah.
Hopefully.
Yeah. So last day. Big show. In about 10 minutes, we have an interview I did a week or two ago with Tollef Olsen, who is the founder and CEO of Ocean Approved. They're doing some really interesting thing with aqua farming, specifically with kelp. And if you remember, Deb, we talked to him about the delicious and nutritional benefits of kelp.
Yes, we did.
Kelp is the new kale.
Yes. Yes, it is.
Yeah. So we're going to be talking about that. And then in the second hour, did an interview earlier today with Mark Garang, who is the publisher of the Portland Phoenix. Mm-hmm. So right after the news break at 12:06 on what's going on in publishing and entertainment and music and their audience, what's going on here in Southern Maine.
Yep.
So why don't we start with some On This Day.
On This Day.
On This Day, February 28th, number one element to cover on this day is it's Shani McShani's last day. Did you know that?
Yes, I did.
Yeah, she's leaving us.
I know.
Kind of a contract dispute. I hated to kind of air this dirty laundry in public, but...
You won't pony up to what she wants, huh?
Big demands.
Yeah.
Shani. Well, the reality is the heart knows what the heart knows.
Yes.
And apparently Shani McShani is close to closing a deal with the love of her life.
Yes.
And they're moving to beautiful Camden.
Yeah, great place.
Is that how you would put it, closing the deal? Or how would you put it in terms of this big transition in your life, Shani?
I don't think I would quite put it that way, but I am moving into the next chapter of my life.
And what's the plan? Because at 5 o'clock today, security will escort you out of the building.
Oh, dear.
And a box of your things will follow, you know, a few minutes later.
Right.
Thrown from the second story, so we get the visual. But after that happens at 5:03,
mm-hmm.
what does the next chapter of Shani McShani looks like?
Well, I'll probably begin nesting.
Nesting. Wow.
Which is always a good thing.
You're going to be nesting.
We girls, we like to nest.
Yeah.
What is nesting, and to what extent will the FCC allow you to describe your process in nesting?
I would just say, you know, being a homebody and taking care of myself and my man.
Taking
and your home. She sounds like me.
Care of yourself and your man.
Right. Yes. Right.
That's the nesting thing?
Yeah,
well, I can see
you preparing a house
I can
for
see
family.
Why you would want to leave a meteoric career in broadcasting and marketing. I can see when you put it like that with nesting. Yeah. No, all kidding aside, wish you the very best, Shani. You've done a great job here, and I hope that you know you come back and visit.
I will. I absolutely will.
Check in with security. Get a badge. Somebody escorting you through the building. I hope to see you again.
You will. Absolutely.
Okay.
Thank you.
We're going to miss her.
Yeah. Anything else, Deb? You want to say any other good thoughts? Come on. You're the sensitive one here. I'm usually just kind of the...
She's going to do good things. I know she is.
Yeah.
She's amazing.
Yeah. Shani McShani's pretty sharp. Yeah. We like her. Okay. Moving right along. On this day, February 28th, 1983, one of my favorite shows of all time.
Yeah.
MASH. MASH was on for 11. This was back before cable really, there was cable TV back then, but it wasn't as diverse as it is now. It was still really the three networks, ABC, CBS, and NBC. And it was on for 11 seasons on CBS.
Yeah.
And the final episode ended in 1983. And at the time, it was one of the most watched TV show ever. 77% of the whole TV audience kind of Hawkeye Pierce. Fantastic.
Yep. Good stuff.
Other birthdays, Mario Andretti. He turned 75, open wheel racing guy.
Mm-hmm.
And one of my favorite singers, Train, Patrick Monahan. Do we have his big hit song? Yeah, Patrick Monahan. Train never quite got to the stratospheric level of music popularity, but they were certainly, and they continue to be, a popular group.
Are they done?
No, they still play out. Okay. It's a generational thing. Shani, you're our music expert. Is your generation tuned into Train?
Kind of. I mean, they have some new stuff that's pretty good, plays on the radio currently.
Yeah, yeah. Speaking of that, tell me this. Why do people in your generation, and now I feel like an old guy saying, get off my lawn. Like I feel like I'm that guy. But why do people in your generation have such a disdain for Nickelback?
Ugh.
You don't like Nickelback?
Are you serious?
Yeah, they're
awful. They are not awful. Take it back.
They are amazing.
Nickelback.
Oh, I'm outnumbered.
Oh.
Nickelback, how can you say that?
Wow.
They don't have a birthday or an on this day, but every time Nickelback is mentioned on Facebook and Twitter, people just, it's become this popular thing to just, you know, to diss,
trash them.
To hate trash them. Nickelback.
Yeah.
Yep.
What don't you like about them?
All of it. Their songs, they're fun to hate.
Oh, one of those.
See, I think it's more like this power suggestion. I think there's this whole generation that got together and they're like, hey, how about we get together and we just be really critical of Nickelback? Do you know where the name Nickelback came from?
No.
Shani McShani, since you have such a hatred for the group, you should know their whole mythology. No? Really?
No, I don't.
Okay. His brother, the lead singer, whose name I can't remember, he just married, what's her name? The little waifish singer.
Waifish singer?
Waifish. Well, tiny. Is waifish bad?
Mary-Kate Olsen?
Is she waifish?
Yes.
No. The Nickelback guy married Avril Lavigne.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Believe it or not.
Okay.
They got married. But the name Nickelback, his brother was working, I think, at Starbucks.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, the coffee was either like 95 cents with tax or it was $1.95. And his brother, 100 times a day, would say, want your Nickelback? Oh. Nickelback? You want your Nickelback?
That's clever.
That is clever.
Here's your Nickelback. And then all of a sudden he heard it over and over and said, Nickelback. Yeah.
No kidding.
See, since we had an extra 5 minutes for on this day, you see how I was able to stretch the time?
That was amazing. You're good at solving.
That is advanced radio.
Yes.
A lesser host would be like, let's just talk about some sort of inane, insipid gibberish. But no, I fit
not
in.
Not you, Steve-O.
The tribute to Shani McShani, Nickelback. What else do we have here?
Very nice.
You know what happens this weekend? House of Cards. You going to watch?
Yeah, it's going to start.
13 episodes on Netflix.
Yeah.
I don't know if our audience has been paying attention, but this will be the third season.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Kevin Spacey and Robin Wright. Is Penn. God, she was married to Sean Penn. You know what? That was so awful.
She's so true.
It was like a mistake. That's why I'm not even going to say Robin Wright Penn. Robin Wright.
Okay.
Wow.
I'm not going to recognize. He's a great actor.
Mm-hmm.
Absolutely great. But he always just came across as kind of punky. Anyhow, House of Cards gets released. It's really interesting. Netflix releases the whole season at once.
Yes.
So all 13 episodes.
Have you seen the original version, the British version?
No, I've heard about it.
Oh, you should.
Now, I'm so into the U.S. version that I don't want to pollute my thinking. Who's your favorite?
You would pollute it,
Who's
too.
Your favorite character?
Oh, well, him. Kevin Spacey's cat. What is his name?
Frank Underwood.
Frank Underwood.
He's now president.
I know.
The season starts. So for 2 years, he was conniving and he killed people. Mm. He pushed this girl onto a train.
I think it's going to get better.
You think it's even going to get better?
Mm-hmm.
And now he's hanging out. And you know what? His wife is even more ruthless.
Yes. She's even more ruthless, mm-hmm. yes.
Yeah, women are tougher, I think.
Mm-hmm.
go to Netflix. If you don't have a Netflix subscription,
sign up for one.
Sign up for at least a couple of days. Watch all 13 episodes.
Binge watch.
But you've got to watch those two seasons prior to really appreciate, I think, what you're going to see this time.
Yeah. Yeah, because he started out as a congressman, yeah, and then he kind of killed his way to the top.
He sure did.
Yeah, brutal. Reminds you a little bit about Maine politics, doesn't it?
Sure does. It's,
yeah. Oh, can I tell you a funny story?
Sure.
Because that's why we're here at Times More Talk with Steve-O. Yes. I was with Congresswoman Shelley Pingree a few years ago, yeah, a year or two ago. And I asked Congressman, do you watch House of Cards? And she said, are we off the record? Kidding. Finger crossed, Shelley Pingree. I'm kidding. She didn't say that. She goes, yeah, it's an interesting show. The reality is we're not that clever in Washington. So I said, but the Frank Underwood character, who does that remind you of? You know, I was hoping for her to use kind of an example of somebody there.
Mm-hmm.
But she wouldn't divulge. She wouldn't dish. Anyhow, but with that, why don't we get to the first interview? And again, best wishes to Shani McShani, who this will be her last show.
Yeah.
She'll be in Camden. If any of our listeners want to find her and say hi, get an autograph, she'll be just wandering the streets of Camden.
Yep.
And so good luck, Shani. So right now we're going to go into an interview that I did with Tollef Olson, and we're going to talk about aqua farming and kelp. And then after the news break at 12:06, we'll be coming right back with Mark Goring, who is the publisher of the Portland Phoenix. Thank you for being with us this Saturday, February 28th at Times Smart Talk with Steve-O. You're listening to News Talk WLOB, 1310 a.m. Here we go. I was all set to introduce our guest, but I like this song so much, I just want to go one more verse. Do you remember this song?
Yeah. I do.
70s?
Yes.
Jackson Brown, Rock Me on the Water. As a son of a son of a sailor myself, I'm particularly keen to this. Well, let's not delay. We've got a special guest, but
it's a great song.
Please join me in welcoming Tollef Olson. Tollef, great having you here today.
Good morning, Steve. Thank you.
Tollef is a Maine native. He is founder of Ocean Approved, which we'll talk about, and previously founder of Aqua Farms. So we'll be talking things aqua-esque, and being here at Tide Smart, there's a particular synergy here, which we'll also tie into. But if we can start with a little bit of your background in terms of where you were born and raised in Auburn, Maine, is that right?
Well, actually born in Lewiston. Auburn still doesn't have a hospital.
Oh, okay.
And so, yes, I was raised in Auburn.
So talk a little bit about growing up in Maine, and then we'll talk a little bit about your background that kind of led you into your current endeavor, and then we'll talk about what's happening with Ocean Approved and kelp and all that.
Well, I started in Auburn, Maine, and from the time I was a young child, I always enjoyed going down to the coast. I really have salt water in my blood and always found myself returning to the ocean, so I've ultimately made it my career.
And did you go to school here? And where did you get your technical training in terms of these two endeavors?
Actually, I went through Walton up in Auburn, and then my family moved to Naples, Florida in 1970. I actually have no formal education. My education has actually been garnered on the water and through the various projects I've been involved in.
Me too. You know, it comes up all the time. People want to know, hey, Steve, where'd you go to school?
Where'd you go?
I know. In my case, it took me 5 years to get through Needham High School, which is outside of Boston. Woodshop really kicked my butt. But I started working when I was 17. So, and for some reason, I think, not that there's a bias, but for people that actually work and apply themselves, whether or not it's in an academic environment or an institution environment versus work, there shouldn't be any bias.
No.
Right?
So I agree.
So, Tollef, we're in the same club. So I knew I liked you right from the start, Tollef.
Well, it's very simple for me. I took off surfing in Costa Rica when I was 15. I only lasted 3 years in high school, so I didn't last as long as you. But the traveling was quite an education.
Well, and it looks like you've traveled all over. My notes shows that you were very much involved with diving and Spent time in South America, Europe, Southeast Asia, Australia, Bahamas, Caribbean. And talk a little bit about your experience and your personal interest in diving and what type of diving you did, and then we'll talk a little bit into aquaculture.
Well, as I said before, I've always been totally fascinated and drawn to the ocean. And so at an early age, I took up surfing and really stuck with it. And from there, I learned a lot about operating boats. I became familiar with traveling around the world and got involved in groups that look for old shipwrecks, specifically mostly Spanish shipwrecks, but I've worked on Dutch shipwrecks and others also.
I'm guessing here, because we're probably in a similar generation. Jacques Cousteau, you ever watch Jacques Cousteau?
Watched Jacques Cousteau. Actually, I worked with Mel Fisher off and on down in the Keys while he was still alive, another name a lot of people know.
Yeah, that was my favorite show. I don't even know if it was in the 60s or 70s. It was on for a while.
Well, we started with Sea Hunt, so I might be a little older than you. And then we went to Jacques Cousteau.
No, you aren't. Sea Hunt with, what's his name, Nelson.
Was it Mike Nelson?
Yeah, Mike Nelson was the character. But Sea Hunt was unbelievable. It had this futuristic sub that looked like kind of a squid. And, you know, I actually go back with McHale's Navy, too. So my ocean experiences with, you know, McHale's Navy and then obviously Gilligan's Island, which was high drama. But Sea Hunt was the classic.
Well, I'll keep trying to predate you because I'll go to Jules Verne and 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea, and I've been fascinated with the concept of farming the ocean since I read that book.
Okay, you've beat me. Okay. Okay, if it's going to be like this, Tolliff, I'll find something I can beat you on here. But Jacques Cousteau, I want to stop there for a second because his style, his weekly style, kind of documentary style, was so fascinating to me as a kid in the 60s, 70s, and again, I don't know exactly when it was on. But it was Jacques Cousteau, which right away, the name Jacques Cousteau, there was like this weird credibility. It just has this rhythm to it. And then you had the Calypso. Then you had Philippe and his kids, and they would jump in the inflatables, and they would – and at that point, I don't know if it was the combination of where television was or where technology was for underwater photography – but it kind of came together and became – it made it very accessible and very popular. And I remember watching – you know, and I didn't really have a lot of personal interest in what was happening in the ocean other than just, you know, caring about the environment. But he would go down into faraway places and go search out some little sea creature. And for an hour, I couldn't turn my eyes.
Well, Jacques Cousteau and another gentleman – I can't remember his name in the 50s – actually created the Aqualung, which then – created the opportunity for free diving in the ocean other than being tethered like the old sponge divers. And that's one of the reasons they were able to generate such beautiful photography and at the time such forward-looking photography and activities under the water. They were actually swimming free for the first time without having to surface for a long period of time.
Yeah, I remember that so clearly. Deb, you remember that? Is that a whole different generation?
Oh, no, I remember it. I used to watch it too.
And it was done in this style where it wasn't like reality TV. It wasn't scripted. It was really just some marine biologists, scientists, people who love being on the ocean. Mm-hmm. And it was kind of a family thing. And Jacques Cousteau seemed like the most gentle, thoughtful man. And so when he was talking about something and he was sending Philippe off the side, it was like, of course, Jacques Cousteau.
One of the things I always loved is he showed a lot of respect for the ocean and the environmental concerns and the problems that we've generated in our lifetime on this planet. And that was a very large part of his overall platform.
Yeah, and it wasn't as organized as something like Greenpeace, which I want to get your thoughts on, but it was just from a thoughtful, mindful approach where he showed, you know, whether it's coral reef or, you know, people aren't aware that it's a living organism. People think of, I think most people think of coral reef as it's like rock or ledge as opposed to it's a living organism. Right?
It's billions of individual polyps. The other thing Jacques Cousteau did, like National Geographic, he brought to the home sights and sounds that you would never find in central Maine as a youth. And these that created opportunities for people to imagine places they could go in the future.
So talk about your early time. So you had an interest in the ocean. You had an interest in diving. And how was it that you ended up able to go to all over the world and being involved with shipwrecks and diving? And then how did that evolve into aquaculture later on in terms of both a business and a professional interest?
Actually, simpler than you would think. I've always had a great fascination with food. I do have quite a bit of restaurant experience, but I have also an extensive background in commercial fishing, which gave me the technical abilities to run boats, operate any place in the world. My early surf travels made me very comfortable traveling and dealing with the different problems you run into in logistics as you travel around the world. So between the fact that I could run boats, I was highly qualified in the water as a diver, and I've never found an offshore boat yet that doesn't mind having one extra cook on board, it was very easy for me to find berths.
That's interesting. We have Tollef Olson here. He's the founder of Ocean Approved. By the way, their website is oceanapproved.com. So talk a little bit about, you started your career, it looks like, as the founder of Aqua Farms. And talk a little bit about that business and also kind of the overview of aqua or ocean farming in the science of that, and then we'll talk a little bit about Ocean Approved.
It's pretty simple. I moved back to Maine in 1993, and Maine is a very difficult place for a person to find a job. I've been involved in many commercial fisheries, and when I came back, I went into the urchin industry. I had been gone since 87 when I sold my restaurant, and I started looking at aquaculture opportunities right away. I've seen so many fisheries go boom and bust worldwide in my lifetime. Plus, I know, according to the FAO, the Food and Agriculture Organization branch of the United Nations, we cannot feed the projected population past about 2035, 2050 with our current food model. So I started looking at ways to get into aquaculture. And I started with mussels in 1997, 1998, because they were relatively easy entry-level aquaculture, as say, compared to a finfish type operation.
And talk a little bit about, you know, why is that? Are they sturdier in terms of, is it better ROI in terms of how much it takes to kind of manage that as a fishery?
There are several different reasons. In Maine, we have to get lease area from the state of Maine to do any type of aquaculture project. And there are a lot of stringent rules and regulations on that. Shellfish, seaweed aren't quite as difficult as the fish are. The mussels under the Clean Water Act were zero discharge, which actually had a lot of appeal to me. And you could actually capture your seed in the wild, so there was less infrastructure needed. Mainly, you needed a raft, a platform, and a way to protect them from the eider ducks. They also had a fairly short grow period. If you get into the oyster industry, you might be 3 years away from your first crop. And the mussels, you could get a crop to market in as little as 15 to 18 months, which generates cash flow. As a small business, obviously, that's an important factor.
Yeah, and being in Maine, as you said before, we have a relatively underpowered economic engine, so anything you do here, you really need to try to maximize it. Before we get off, I'm fascinated with aqua farming and the future, not only here in Maine, but around the country. But you mentioned something about boats and started with your interest in the ocean and diving and then boats. Aside from, you know, we're going to talk about the food element of kelp and mussels and growing things in the ocean, but something I've always wondered is many boats, if they're diesel powered or if they're gas, I've had boats in the past and I love boating, but they're also, there's an impact in the water and the ocean when you're using oil or diesel in big boats. Why hasn't solar, you know, and obviously most fishing takes place during the day, some at night, but is it the weight of the battery systems? I've been waiting, because you mentioned you've been on every kind of boat, for the solar power industry to really develop a technology for boating that, you know, if you're in a boat, you probably have an unobstructed view of the sky, so relative to solar access. And it just feels like, I think there's been a couple of projects where boats or little kind of putt-putt boats going around harbors, but do you see any, from your experience, any application or any future to have large-scale solar-powered boats as opposed to, you know, just running on diesel and gas?
Absolutely. I think we will end up leading to that. And as you said, the gas and the diesel, there are some drawbacks with that, omelets and eggs. But the batteries are probably one of the biggest things. One of the reasons we don't use friendship sloops and sail anymore is because they were so slow and you couldn't go against the wind. To try to generate enough power to spin a prop large enough to be efficient in a commercial application is very difficult with just the solar power. There is a company now, I can't think of the name of it, that's been working on that in Maine. They are working on it right now. And they do have a beautiful, smaller pleasure boat. But you're talking slow. You're talking not being able to move weight yet. I think probably within our lifetime or certainly shortly thereafter, we will see solar-powered vessels.
Yeah, it's just – I think there's so much research being done in terms of – not only in terms of boating, but you know, we're figuring out how to harness some of the power from the sun, but we're still a long ways off in terms of how to store it because of the weight and the density and the size of most battery systems. There's an obstacle for most cars. You know, Tesla has a little different profile, but boy, I'd love to see that in boating because, you know, I used to like going fast in boats, but like everything else, like
really,
Deb, yeah, like you, Deb,
past the speed limit,
you know. No, don't go there, Deb. But you know, at one point, you know, in a speedboat zipping around. But now, you know, love going out in Casco Bay. It and I love getting some ice cream right there by the Peaks Island Ferry Terminal. I don't need to rush out there. I want to go slow. Mm-hmm. And so the whole obstacle of going fast, not a problem for me, Tolf. I just want to kind of go out there. Maybe I go out to Great Diamond, have a nice meal.
That'd be nice.
And then I just, with my little solar boat that I don't have yet, I go over to Peaks, get some ice cream. A little kid's walking his dog. I go, hey, Jimmy. And he's like, hey, Steve-O. That's what I'm looking for.
That would work well for you.
I'm not looking for firing up the blowers, getting the two engines going, you know, hearing. I don't really need that anymore.
Yeah.
So. Well, you know, that brings up a really good point, too. I think you'll see aquaculture to be one of the first commercial fishing industries to move into solar because speed isn't quite as important as it can be in some of the other fisheries where you're constantly moving to new areas and having to travel further to get your crop, so to speak. Due to the fixed nature of aquaculture, I believe it probably will be a leader in that type of innovation.
Wow. And if I could be part of that anyway, Tolf, we'll talk about it after the radio show. But I'm not sure if you're aware, but here at TideSmart, we're solar powered, and we're building on the other side of the campus the first net positive building in Maine, and no furnace, no fossil fuels, slab foundation, super insulation, solar. Will actually be our own little utility almost in that we're providing power to CMP.
There you go.
So we'll even send some your way, Deb. I know you like the power.
I
know
I'll need it.
Yeah, you need lots of power. By the way, we have Tolf Olson here. He is the founder of Ocean Approved, and he is a leader and a thought leader in terms of ocean aquaculture. And one of the elements is harvesting kelp from here on the coast of Maine. You're listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O on News Talk WLLB, 1310 AM. Let's move on and talk a little bit about Ocean Approved and specifically kelp and kelp farming, which I think is central to your business, and talk a little bit about how you moved into that. And then let's talk about what you're actually doing and what is the scale, what is the market, and what's the future for kelp farming.
Well, it's pretty simple. I came up with the concept back in the 1980s. I had a restaurant in Bar Harbor, and I'd always been fascinated by aquaculture overseas and saw that it had a great future in Maine, but at that point, it had barely begun. Seaweed always fascinated me because it goes along with something you just said. We've got a crop now that we're growing where we use no arable land. We had no fertilizers. We used no water. We used no insecticides. We used no herbicides. It sequesters CO2. Releasing oxygen as it grows, you can't find a much greener crop than this. The problem was, and still is somewhat, is there's a dedicated seaweed consumer, and they're used to the dried seaweed products that have been on the market for millennia. They're excellent products. Their taste, the taste is something that's somewhat acquired. They're very healthy, but I like the analogy of a dried pea to a frozen or a fresh pea. Once you dry a pea, you can never make it green, sweet, snappy again. And this was the idea I had way back in the 80s, was let's serve kelp as a fresh vegetable as opposed to a dried vegetable. Kelp's unique. It actually freezes in the wild. And because of this, the way that we process it and then stabilize it and then freeze it, it doesn't break down like some foods do when they're frozen. The problem was, and I actually spoke to Shep Earhart from Maine Coast Sea Vegetables at the time, who was in the industry 40 years ago and still is the seaweed industry, is that, well, but that's not how the market does it. What we see is a changing demographic now. We see a more involved consumer. This isn't only the ecological benefits. It's also the socioeconomic benefits. This is something that can bring jobs home to the coast and jobs that have a future, jobs that will last into the 22nd century. This isn't a flash in the pan, get-rich-quick type fishery like we saw with the urchins. It isn't a boom-and-bust fishery where technology finally gets so good that the fish can't keep up. This is a way to feed the Earth's population well into the future.
This is probably an ignorant question to ask, but you know, some of the vernacular, some of the words you've used to describe as both kelp and seaweed. What is, are they one and the same, or if you can kind of give a description of kelp versus seaweed and how it's described and, you know, how it ties into the aqua culture.
Well, seaweeds are all the algals or algaes that are growing in the ocean. Kelp is actually a generic term that came out of Europe about 100 years ago. We in the United States use it to cover the laminarias, which are the dominant food products that we see and that we are operating with ocean approved. That said, there are people who work North Atlantic Kelp Company actually sells rockweed, which technically, under the loose terms of kelp, is a kelp. The kelps that we do are actually macroalgae. They're from the laminaria family. We work with Alaria. We work with digitata laminaria, and we also work with Alaria esquilenta. And they're all closely related. These are the larger brown macroalgae, and they're prevalent along our coast. And so they are the ideal kelps to do in an aquaculture situation. We can, in one season, get them to market in a fashion that the consumer loves.
Wow. Take me from the kind of the growth cycle in the fishery harvesting cycle and the seed cycle of kelp in terms of if I wanted to open up my own kelp farm, how would I start? Do you start in a warehouse environment where you cultivate kelp seed? And then do you have to be in a particular area with a particular tidal range? And then what is the life cycle? And then actually, how do you literally harvest the kelp?
Well, you know, as the first kelp farm in the U.S. and the first kelp company in the world to produce it in the fashion that we are, we're totally vertically integrated to the point where it's very difficult. We had a lot of luck early on and a lot of assistance with MTI and then NOAA SBIR, and we achieved a couple of grants that allowed us to actually create the technology to generate seed here in the U.S. We've actually learned now to induce the kelp to spore off in a controlled situation where we then control the food and light for a month before introducing it to the ocean. We actually wrote the book, and it is available to the general public.
You literally wrote the book, not just figuratively.
Literally.
Literally.
Yes. And from there, we designed farms of very simple nature that we think will transform well into the existing fisheries. Hopefully, as this industry grows, it's huge. Worldwide, as much as 25 million metric tons have been farmed annually in good years, and Maine is just now becoming a player in this. And so what we envision down the line is this being a huge industry that can incorporate many of the different fisheries or people who want to work on the water who don't have opportunities now as the demand increases. Now, the demand increasing is another whole different story. That's getting into the market aspect of it. And when you're marketing a product that didn't exist in this form before, well, that's another whole set of hurdles you have to jump through.
So how do you actually harvest it? I think you mentioned that prior to introducing it to the ocean, you grow it in a controlled environment, I'm guessing some sort of warehouse, some sort of inside fishery with the right light and air and all that.
Correct. We did the experimental work over at the Gulf of Maine Research Institute, and we now are actually creating our seed over at Southern Maine Community College. What we do is we induce the spores to release, and then we provide a substrate, which is simply string around a piece of PVC. And we keep these in aquaria under controlled temperature, light, and food circumstances for approximately 30 days. Then we move them out to the farms. And this is a pretty simple procedure. We just fasten a piece of line to our fixed gear, which is our mooring. We run the line through the piece of PVC, secure the string that the kelp spores are on to the piece of line, back the boat up, and it just spirals out around this piece of line, and then you secure it to the moorings on the other end. At this point, Mother Nature takes over. We've got it suspended 7 feet in our locations below the sea, and we have more than enough nitrogen, phosphorus, CO2, food for the kelp available in the natural environment. So we're actually cleaning up the ocean while generating what is arguably the healthiest or growing what is arguably the healthiest vegetable you can eat. After a period of, say, 4 to 7 months, we harvest it. And the harvest is fairly simple. You just lift the lines out of the water and trim the kelp off the lines and then take it in for processing.
So all the kelp grows from the line where the spore was originally attached to?
That's correct. Kelp is interesting. It feeds actually from the blade, and it has a holdfast, which looks sort of like roots, but they're not actually roots. And all it does is attach to the substrate, which we provided, and that's the line. And then the blade actually grows out from the line, the stipe and the blade, and it undulates in the water. And the undulation is what allows it to have a lot of surface area contact with the ocean, and this is how it gets its nutrition.
Wow. You know, I'm going to jump around here a little bit because I want to get back to kelp. Deb is a kelp consumer. She loves the kelp. But you mentioned about the nutrients in the water and the ocean and the farming. Talk a little bit about ocean conditions relative to acidity, temperature, things like that that are connected, most scientists would agree, are connected to climate change and what's happening in the environment. As a fishery, is kelp less sensitive, more sensitive to acidity levels? Is it a sturdier fishery versus there are some species that aren't doing really well? And as an example, you know, Cape Cod, I grew up outside of Boston, and there actually used to be cod around Cape Cod, hence the name. And that fishery, I think, is, you know, from people I've talked to, has been greatly depleted. So talk about how sensitive the ocean is to changing chemistry in the ocean and temperatures and levels and all that.
Well, the kelp definitely is it's affected by temperature. The southern range of kelp used to be down around New York Harbor, the south end, east, west end of Long Island. Now it's kind of moved over towards the Connecticut end of Long Island and slowly creeping north as temperatures increase. On the acidity side, kelp actually is beneficial. In the lab, when we're raising our seed, we actually see the CO2, the pH level rise before we put it in the ocean because it's absorbing the CO2. And so that lends all kinds of possibilities down the road, but the ocean is very large. One of the problems with the acidification, which does not adversely affect the kelp because it just sees the CO2 and the pH, it's a food factor, is we're seeing troubles with shellfish. As we see the pH decrease due to ocean acidification, which is created by CO2 in the atmosphere, but it's also created by nitrogen runoff, we see damage to juvenile shellfish shells. And the Friends of Casco Bay have some very graphic pictures and examples of what happens when you place juvenile clams in an acidified mud bank. Part of the beauty of kelp is it actually helps nullify that. Not to a degree yet that we could actually control any environments, but at least it's not part of the problem.
I'm aware. I'm a proud resident of Yarmouth, home of the Clam Festival. And there's a lot of research being done relative to clam fishery and what's happening in the flats. Also, green crabs. Is that what they're called, green crabs?
Yes, so green crabs have been a real big problem.
Invasive species almost, where they're taking, you know, clam seeds and consuming them before they can kind of grow with a protective shell, right?
Yes, they are, and they are an invasive species. Luckily, last winter and now this winter, I think these brutal winters are actually going to set them back just a little bit. This year, the population was not as bad as it has been in the past. That said, this is a population that is slowly creeping to the east, from west to east, and it is definitely a problem along with acidification for the shellfish industry.
Interesting. Deb, what's your favorite kelp dish? When you're sitting down and you want a big plate of
so many to choose from. No, you know, I have a question for you. Like you said, the marketing part and the consuming part is going to be the hardest piece here. How do you plan to bring this to the public on a more large scale? How are we going to get kelp to be something that's going to be in our diet that we really want and look forward to?
Well, one thing we've done is we've been targeting high schools and universities, and we find that this is a very receptive audience. They're receptive for many reasons. You have a younger generation that is looking for new foods, socioeconomically and ecologically correct foods. We also have a huge health issue here. Kelp is literally a multivitamin with fiber, and this actually bridges the generations. Kelp is an incredible source of iodine. Our generation, my generation, grew up with Morton's iodized salt. This was actually done by the government on purpose, and we all used a lot of table salt. Well, sea salt has no iodine, and people are becoming aware of this. Iodine is very necessary in the controlling of your metabolism, and there have actually been studies that show that proper iodine intake, a study of 39,000 nurses in Japan showed a statistical decrease in breast cancer due to kelp consumption accredited to the iodine in it. So part of the – one of the marketing ploys is not only are we growing something in a fashion that doesn't hurt the ecology, we're growing something so that, that is so incredibly healthy for you. It is literally adding a multivitamin, nature's multivitamin, to whatever dish you incorporate it in.
Mm-hmm. And what are some of the dishes? So once you harvest kelp, and the other thing I think kelp has in its favor is kale. Somewhere in the last 5 years, you know, Katie eats kale like, you know, I eat Dunkin' Donuts. She's all about the kale. And so... and kale has been a huge success. And I didn't even, there wasn't even much awareness of kale.
Right.
And all of a sudden, kale comes onto the landscape as nutritionist. It's growing. And so if kelp can kind of like, it sounds like kale.
Yeah.
There's kelp, there's kale. Hey, they ran out of kale, so I've got some kelp. Maybe there's something there.
Well, there really is. And actually, I think it was the New York Times, but a major publication just recently said kelp, the new kale. Kelp actually has a much healthier profile than kale does.
Really? I thought I just came up with that. Talif, by the way, we have Talif Alsit here. He is the founder of Ocean Approved. They're involved with harvesting and research in terms of aquaculture. So I wasn't the first person that made the connection between kale and kelp, you're saying, huh?
No, you weren't. And that's part of the thing that's fun about what we do. Kelp is brown when it comes out of the ocean. It's brown when it's dried. But due to photosynthesis and chlorophyll, it turns green as soon as part of our processing. And so we have a mild green vegetable that is actually more palatable than kale and probably more versatile than the applications.
What are some of the applications? And let's talk about once it's harvested, what is the market like? Talk a little bit about kind of the business market, where what retailers, what, where is kelp now available? And then what are the traditional dishes that kelp is integrated into? Is it a salad, considered a salad vegetable, or can it be, ground
sauteed.
Up, sauteed or liquefied and put into a smoothie? Or, you know, what's the future like? But start with kind of the retail component. So if people are listening right now and they're like, I need to get me some kelp. Where can they get it here in Maine? Where is it available? And then talk a little bit about how it's being involved and integrated into diet.
Well, we're limited on the retail basis. I know that you can pick it up down at Harbor Fish on Commercial Street, Brown Trading. I am not 100% sure because we don't do much direct marketing. I know there are other retail sources available. Always check in your local health food store, and you can always ask them to carry the ocean-approved products. On the other front, where you're talking about the different uses, well, the answer is all the above, D. Literally from eggs in the morning to carrot cake or a dessert after dinner, there's nothing you cannot incorporate the kelp, our kelps, into, and we sell it in various forms to facilitate this. We actually sell a kelp smoothie cube now, which is a cube that'll give you all your daily iodine. All you have to do is throw one in the blender with your smoothie. We have a product that goes beautifully in a salad, flatbreads down on Commercial Street, tops their salads with our kelp. I go down to Johnson & Wales on a regular basis, their campus down in Rhode Island in Providence, and I work with the culinary department there. And we have put this in anything you can imagine and found ways to make it easy to use. A lot of people still have a misconception about kelp. They think about something they see on the beach. And my response has always been, when was the last time you picked a fish up off the beach and ate it? And kelp picked, harvested fresh, prepared properly and brought to the table in its proper fashion is a very mild green vegetable.
And what's the what's kind of the life cycle of kelp in terms of how it keeps, and is it comparable to other vegetables or lettuce or vegetables where if you have to be refrigerated, or can you store it dry? Are there any other properties about kelp people should know about?
Well, kelp has been dried for millennia. You have to remember this is a plant that's coming out of the ocean. It doesn't want to be in the atmosphere. So you can't store it like a potato or a carrot or a squash in your root cellar. And this is why traditionally kelp has been sold as a dried product. And the dried products are very good. They're very healthy for you. But they're a little more difficult for some consumers to wrap their head around and how to use them. And that's where my idea came up with, that I came up with in the 80s and then that we incorporated into this company, is we take it from the ocean. We stabilize it instantly while it's still at its freshest state, and then we freeze it. As I said earlier, kelp freezes on the low tides. It has a unique molecular structure that allows it to live. It can freeze and then live. A night like last night at low tide, there was kelp exposed that is still living today in the ocean. So we take it, we blanch it, we cut it, we process it, and we freeze it instantly while it's in its best state. And I'm a very, very picky, not eater, but very picky about the quality of my foods. I don't like frozen seafood. I cannot tell the difference between today's harvested kelp or kelp from 2 or 3 years ago even. Before I opened this company, I held some kelp in my home freezer for over 3 years, which is not an ideal environment because you don't have a super low temperature and it opens and closes all the time. Did not change one bit in its consistency.
Without getting too deep in the science, how is it a living organism can live when it's frozen? I mean, what is the makeup? Is it so fibrous that it just retains, live organisms deep down and the exterior freezes? Or, what's the science behind how kelp can do this thing where it's exposed to freezing temperatures and then, it gets submerged in water and it comes back to life?
I don't think that the scientists have even completely identified how it does that. Mussels actually can do it to a certain extent also, but not to the extent that the kelp can. You mentioned fibrous. Well, it is a really good source of fiber. The kelps actually have more fiber than brown rice. And so that's just one more beneficial aspect of it in diet. But I don't think the scientists have actually even completely identified how it can do that, but it does.
Are there a number of different strains? And is there a way to, I don't want to call it a GMO, but is there a way to genetically create different strains of kelp that may have different properties, different levels of iodine or different taste profiles? Or is it mostly just one kind of central strain?
Well, that's a very interesting question. And we actually did some studies with MIT on that. And there have been lots of questions with different strains of kelp in Maine, whether they're actually the same kelp or different kelps. And what we found is the ocean dynamics can actually change the shape of the growing organism. The flavors can vary a little bit, like anything from different parts of the ocean, but you don't see as much variance in the flavor as you would, say, in shellfish, where you have a filter feeder that really holds more of the water in. So the kelp hasn't evolved much in 500 million years. Obviously, it found a niche that worked for it. And so I don't think the GMOs are going to be the way to go. I think it's more of geographic location where you place your farms. And if you want to change the shape or texture, make it a little thicker or a little thinner, one of the ways you can do that is by changing the current or wave action at your aquaculture site.
So talk about Maine. Maine is known worldwide as the kind of the epicenter of lobster as a fishery. And I've traveled all over, and over in Australia, they like their warm water lobster, which I can't stand. So, the Maine lobster is a big thing, and I don't even know what percent of the world consumption of lobster, because, the Canadians are trying to kind of edge into that. But so Maine, my understanding about the lobster fishery is we just have a unique kind of aqua ecosystem where the water temperature is the exact right temperature for lobster. And because of our rocky coast, that is something that, lobsters are really into, rocky coast and places to crawl under and to mate with other lobsters. And, so that's – what is it about Maine that makes it either ideal or less than ideal for kelp? And what are those conditions specific to that?
Well, one of the things is the same thing that makes it ideal for lobsters. It also is one of the things that made the Georges Banks one of the most prolific fishing sites in the Gulf of Maine, one of the most highest producing fish areas in the world. If you look at the basin, the Gulf of Maine is a basin with a couple of outlets out on the other side of the Gulf Stream. It's basically a big enclosed system, lots of food. We have a lot of upwelling. Over the millennia, you have a lot of food that settles to the bottom over the years, and a combination of our currents, cold waters, and wave action allow it to really what we call upwell. It mixes and mixes and mixes. And this is the absolute first link in the food chain before you get your next stage. You get into your phytoplanktons and you get into your fish. And so this is what is unique about Maine, that and our cold water temperatures, as you stated, the rocky shorelines. We have clean water. We have lots of clean water. And we have lots of grow space. One other neat thing about kelp is it's actually a winter crop, which is countercyclical to the industry you were just mentioning, lobsters, which opens up all kinds of potential socioeconomic benefits down the road.
Interesting. Hey, Deb, did you know that Maine has more shoreline than California?
I did.
Counterintuitive, right? With all the edges and islands and everything?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good trivia question.
It's very good.
We also have more shoreline than China, which is the largest kelp farm, the largest kelp producer in the world from farm kelps.
There you go again, Tollef, besting me on trivia. First, I start with one thing, and all of a sudden, you come right back with China. Hey, in the next couple of minutes, this has been great talking with you. We'd love to have more conversations. Talk about the business climate here in Maine. Are there policy issues that impact kelp farming? Are there regulatory issues beyond just kind of the normal business issues of finding a market and having something that's cost effective? Is Maine a willing business partner for both your business and the kelp industry? And if not, what are some things that from a legislative position Maine could be doing a little bit better to promote this type of business?
Well, Maine is a willing participant, but that said, there are barriers in place, and some of them rightly so. In aquaculture, which I consider just an extension of commercial fishing, the newest manifestation of gear, we have a much higher hurdle to pass, a much higher threshold to climb over to get places to grow our food. And this needs to be this way until we understand exactly what we're doing. But as a small businessman, it can take 1 to 3 years to get an aquaculture lease. Try to write a business plan around that. And then we're dealing with food product. Part of the beauty of what our food is, it's actually a cooked, frozen vegetable, which under FDA regs is about as safe as you can get. But, and once again, rightly so, the FDA regs have gotten tougher and tougher and tougher every year. So as a small business, it's hard to, when you have this pull from both sides and all these rules you have to comply with, it's difficult. And then we're competing with a country like, say, China, where they don't have any rules and labor is cheap. That said, Maine is innovative. We're known for our entrepreneurial spirit. And even though there are some hurdles, overall, the climate is really good for this type of project.
What is China doing that we're not? And obviously, they have some challenges relative to their incredible population growth, and it's becoming more industrialized. Is kelp much bigger out of necessity in China as a food source? And how does U.S. policy and the marketplace for kelp compare to China?
Well, there's a couple things there. And, of course, we're not, as a company, trying to compete nose-to-nose with China because we don't do a dried product. But if you actually Google where the kelp is farmed in China, I'll let you make your own decision on whether you want to eat that kelp or not. They don't have the regs that we have here at all. And so they don't have the impediments. So they can grow the kelp a lot cheaper. And we have to work harder here. But in return, or not in return, but what we do is we put a superior product to market and we let that speak for itself.
Wow. I'd love to have you come back sometime because I think, you know, a couple of things. One, food sources here in the country, much like energy, they're not just important things. They are absolutely critical. And we need to figure out as we're hurling through space on this rock called Earth, how we're going to have energy for warmth and to exist, and how we're going to feed a growing population. And so I think aquaculture and the kind of research and work that you're doing is fascinating because every study shows we need to have a better relationship with the ocean relative to both protecting fisheries and growing new fisheries and the stuff that you're doing. And then from the other standpoint, just the economics, Maine needs as many economic engines as we can find. And so I wish you nothing but success going forward, and I'd love to have you come back.
Great. Thank you, Steve.
We've had Tollef Olson here. He's the founder of Ocean Approved. He is a diver, been a chef, business owner, 37 years of experience on the water. I'm jealous. I wish I could go out on the water that much. If you're interested in more information, please go to their website, oceanapproved.com. They're also on Twitter, I believe, at Ocean Approved. And you've been listening to Tide Smart Talk with Steve-O, News Talk WLOB, 1310 AM. We'll be back.